I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Most Americans will tell you that privacy is important to them. I certainly feel that way. And yet we leave a trail of information about where we are, how we shop, our preferences, our friends, our text and email messages through our use of social media, especially on our smartphones. And companies are only too willing to mine and sell this data to advertisers, retailers, and others hungry for information about our behavior and our attitudes. It's a big and profitable business. Increasingly, we live in a world of apps and facial recognition, video doorbells, security cameras, fitness trackers, GPS technology, which raises the question, do we have any control over the personal and private information about us that's bought and sold? We have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Joseph Thoreau. He's the Robert Louis Cheyenne Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. Author of several books, including most recently, The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. In fact, he was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. Joe Thoreau, nice to have you back with us on
Thank you. Radio Times. Same here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from the New York Times studio in New York is Natasha Singer. She's a technology reporter for the New York Times, covers data privacy. She also teaches technology ethics at the high school, to high school students, I should say, at the School of the New York Times. And Natasha Singer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha, let me begin with you. Is everything we do online being tracked by someone?
Wow. So that's a really complicated question, even though
I thought it was such a simple one, but go ahead.
No, the thing is that, like, much of what we do is being tracked, often by dozens of companies, whether you're on sites or you're on apps that have software that send your information to dozens of companies. The issue is, though, it's not just about online tracking, because apps have the ability to track your location, sometimes collecting it every few seconds. And so your physical activities, where you are, whether you go to a supermarket or a church or a mosque or Planned Parenthood or the police station, are also being tracked.
Let me go to you, Joe, and I think you and I are old enough to remember when there wasn't an internet and there weren't apps and social media, and the internet was supposed to be this place where democracy would flourish and there would be the great leveler and there would be lots of wonderful information and we would all be super informed. And I think that's a piece of the world that we live in, but something also has changed when it comes to who we are and information about us.
Well, I think Natasha said it very well. Natasha, by the way, and her work is a reason people ought to subscribe to the New York Times. Hmm. Should say that right off the bat.
Good stuff. Thank you.
But really, what changed the utopian visions of the internet tended to be around before 1994. 94 was the time when commerce began to get in. Now, of course, there's still a lot of utopian views, but once the cookie was invented, and once people realized that you could start tracking people around, it changed the name of the game.
So once there was information and we were leaving this little bit of a trail of information about us, someone wanted to take that information and do something with it.
And in the beginning, it had a very good reason. The cookie was invented in order to be able to see the same person checking out from an online store. But it also had the capabilities of tracking what people were doing on the site and eventually in other sites and things like that.
Natasha, let me go back to you. And you interviewed the author of a book called Surveillance Capitalism. I used that in my introduction. This is a book by Shoshana Zuboff. What is she saying? And this use of surveillance capitalism, I don't want to overuse it, but it seems like a kind of handy reference as we have this discussion.
Yes. Surveillance capitalism is a fancy pants way of saying that companies are collecting your data and then they are analyzing it and making predictions in order to try to influence your behavior.
I mean, and so, yeah, go ahead.
So what Professor Zuboff is arguing is, you know, we keep saying, oh, you know, consumers have to make this tough trade-off. Are they willing to give up their data for these free services? And Professor Zuboff is arguing that it's actually not about the raw data. It's about the power of algorithms and predictive technology to extract these inferences about you and categorize you. And so she's arguing that us that we're constantly being surveilled, scored by these systems, sorted into different categories in order to better influence us to do things sometimes that are better for us, like, you know, a Fitbit might ping you and say you haven't walked 10,000 steps today, and sometimes to shunt you in directions that benefit companies more than you.
Does the public know about this, Natasha? Do we know that this is going on?
Well, I think we know that advertising has always been designed to influence us and that we've always been categorized. If you're a luxury shopper and you buy fancy suitcases at Bloomingdale's, you're going to get a luxury catalog. And if you're buying fishing equipment from L.L. Bean, you're going to get sports catalogs, right? So we already know that we have been datafied and categorized. But I think that it came to public view and concern this year, last year, because of the Russian influence campaign during the elections, because Russian agents were able to use Facebook's self-serve advertising system to target people. For example, they targeted people who liked Malcolm X or Martin Luther King or Chicano hip-hop. And they showed them material first that was really positive, black girls are beautiful, like a very positive community message. But on the day of the presidential election, they showed them messages that said, neither Trump nor Hillary are for you, don't go vote.
Just showing how powerful this kind of messaging is. Joe, one of the things that you've done is to poll people about how they feel about things like that, like this. And what do people tell you?
Well, over the years, we've done several surveys and by phone typically, in fact, all. And what we found is that people know they're being tracked.
They know.
They are nervous about it. They would rather not happen. But more than that, they don't quite understand what data mining is about. They don't know how a lot of the pieces can be put together. And they really reject, however, the idea that companies should tailor things for them. They'd rather do it themselves.
Oh, so they're that sort of convenience explanation doesn't really cut it.
It's a complicated business, but generally we found in two separate surveys in 2012 and 2015, no, 2009 and 2012, that people would rather not have material tailored to their interests. I think it's because they don't want someone else to be doing it for them.
They rather do it themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, who hasn't gone on Facebook and said and checked out, you know, a pair of shoes or something that was advertised, and then next thing you know, you keep seeing this pair of shoes.
That's
following
the most
you
common
around.
Way of following people that way, the remarketing or retargeting. Yeah.
Natasha, have you looked at public opinion on this kind of targeted advertising?
Well, Professor Turow is actually the person who's been doing the surveys.
Right.
And also the Pew Research Study recently, Pew Research Center recently did a study, and they found that about 3/4 of Facebook users didn't even know that the social network had these lists of their personal interests, such as their political leanings, that were being offered to advertisers to target them. And then half of the users in this Pew study who looked at their ad preferences, which are the Facebook pages you can look at to see what it says you're interested in, said they were uncomfortable with Facebook having those kind of lists of categories about them.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important study because Facebook people and other people, people from Google and many other companies in the Interactive Advertising Bureau would say, why don't people see the signs? You know, there are lists. When you go on Facebook, they'll say, check your privacy. Google says, the thing is, people have a life. And the life isn't always on the internet. And, you know, people like me and maybe Natasha are constantly concerned with these issues. Yeah. Most people have a lot of other things to do. And it's very difficult to keep up with this stuff.
Well, what's interesting, Natasha, is you said 3/4 of people didn't even know that this was going on. Does that say that a company like Facebook isn't telling them in a way that they understand that it's going on?
I think when we sign up for these services, there are these 10,000-word terms of service, right? And it says, do you want to join Facebook? You know, here are terms of service. If you agree, click here. And nobody reads these 10,000-word things that often do say, honestly, that they are going to use your data for personalized ads. But, you know, even I, who do read them, they're written in this legalese.
Yeah.
They're written in vague language. And they don't say, you know, Users, we're going to track everything you click on. We're going to analyze your friends and how you're related to them, whether you worked at the same company or went to the same high school. And we have this software that is on tens of millions of sites that's not a Facebook site. So we're going to see what you do when you're on other sites. And also, we have software in many, many apps that have nothing to do with Facebook that if you use, we're also going to get the data, right? So it would be impossible for your average person to understand, you know, and one of the reasons that some of my colleagues and I are looking at this is because you have to actually go into the software and see where the traffic is going mm-hmm. to understand where your data is spreading.
Well, so interesting, Natasha. If what you just said was written in bold type, it would be interesting to see how users would respond to that.
Well, I remember that somebody did this joke privacy policy a while back, a terms of service that said, you know, and at the end of this, the devil will take your soul or something. And people clicked agree because they weren't reading, right? And so basically this notion that there is notice, meaning companies are notifying you and you can make a choice to take it or leave it, is fallacious, right? The system is not working.
And I used to think transparency was a way out, that if you gave people enough information – they would be able to respond. I don't really believe that anymore. I things are too complicated and mm-hmm. they change too quickly.
So there is,
I also think that.
Yeah, go ahead, Natasha.
Sorry,
go.
I just want to add that I think there's another complication and wrinkle in here, which is we keep talking about you are trading your data for free services. But if, for example, you're one of the millions of people who have paid to use Amazon Prime, right, the free shipping service, mm-hmm. and you regularly stream videos or music or read things on your Kindle, Amazon has as much or more information about you than Google or Facebook.
Well, go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
No, so I think that, as Joe said, it's super complicated because it's not just about your data is being extracted by the free services you use, and that's the trade-off. Your data is being extracted and used to try to influence you by everybody.
Well, and by everybody, I mean, were Facebook, Amazon, Google, I mean, Joe, who?
Target.
I mean, who's
about
doing
stores,
this?
Everybody. If you go to the Target privacy policy, it's just as Natasha said. They actually do track everything. They have the right to look at what you say in chat rooms about them, you know, or anything.
But it's also...
Go ahead.
Sorry. I just want to say it's also not just the big companies
yes.
that you've heard of, like Target. So, for example, a few years ago, a cybersecurity expert, Ashkan Soltani, and my colleague Jen, when she was the Wall Street Journal, did this story about buying cars. And it turned out that when folks went online to look at a car... You know, you're trying to decide, are you buying a Toyota Prius or a Ford pickup? And you go to a lot of sites and you sort of figure out what the interest rate might be and you pick a model and a color, whatever. Then you sign up to go to a car dealership. And it turned out that data brokers were collecting this information and selling it to car dealerships. So when you showed up to pick out the car mm-hmm. and test drive the car and negotiate for the car, that salesperson had all this information about you, including financial information, what your price range was. And, you know, there's this $1,000 range where you're negotiating to try to get the price down between the buyer and the salesperson on a car lot. But actually, because the car dealer was armed with all this information, the consumer was actually at a loss, and there was this information imbalance.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll carry on our conversation with Natasha Singer and Joseph Thoreau, and you, 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about how our data is being tracked and mined, traded, and sold by corporations, frankly, that want to influence our choices and behaviors. And some people have been calling this surveillance capitalism. Talking with Joe Thoreau, he's a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Aisles Have Eyes. Natasha Singer joining us from the New York Times studio in New York, and she's a technology reporter for the New York Times who covers data privacy. And you can also tweet us to join our conversation at WHYY Radio Times. Joe, you wanted to talk a bit about sort of our online and
offline
persona.
Just picking up what Natasha was saying, the notion that people often will talk about is offline and online hardly exists anymore because of what Natasha said, that it is trackable. And companies will try to move across platforms and into stores and places to buy cars and elsewhere. Another issue around that is the whole idea that sensitive data is what we should exclude. My point about that is that sensitive can be anything.
Mm-hmm.
What you buy in the supermarket, if it's run through artificial intelligence, can tell what diseases you have. So you may not think it's very sensitive, but it's. I think it's fallacious to believe that there are sensitive and non-sensitive data. We have to be careful about what we give up because we don't know how these things will be inferred.
Well, let me pick up on that. Let's say someone has diabetes, so they're going to stay away from certain foods when they go to the supermarket. How would, let's say, that information migrate to their insurance company, we'll say?
Well, I don't know about the insurance company. It gets very tough that way, and maybe Natasha knows more. But, for example, Kroger owns a data analytics company. And they, I'm sure, parse all the 90% plus of people who go into supermarkets that give frequent shopper cards use them because you lose 20% if you don't use it.
Right.
And as a result, people's shopping habits are scarfed up by these companies. So your menu every week of what you buy, plus some basic demographics about you and maybe a lot more, is right there. And if you have very strong statisticians who understand deep learning and machine learning and other ways to approach data, and they're getting much more sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
these sorts of inferences can easily be made.
And Natasha, you want to add to that? And I mean, I guess these are algorithms that are essentially working overtime to profile us?
Yes, I think it goes two ways. So first of all, researchers have studied Twitter to look for signs of health problems. So, for example, at Boston Children's Hospital did a study looking at how people use Twitter to see if they could predict who was having trouble sleeping and was an insomniac. Mm. And Microsoft has done a study looking at if they can pinpoint depression on Twitter. And so, you know, your non-health data can be used for health purposes. But on the flip side, hospitals are buying consumer data. So the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center had a project where they were buying information about their patients, including data on their education levels, their marital status, their household income, number of cars, but also how they shopped. You know, did they do a lot of online shopping? Because they were trying to predict who would need to go to the emergency room, which is a really expensive service. And for example, if you shopped online and didn't have a car, you would be more likely to call an ambulance than you were to drive yourself to the doctor's office, right? And so they were trying to make categorizations between patients and try to save money by identifying those, predicting who was going to more likely call the emergency services and then have more preventive services given to them so that didn't happen.
Joe, do they want to know about us individually or collectively, if you know what I mean?
Right. Both. But increasingly, I would argue individually. Personalization is sort of the mantra of, I would say, the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that categories of segments were the way that marketers talked about people. Increasingly, it's personal
it's you,
data.
It's me.
Yeah.
It's Natasha.
And
it's our
sort of combination of that, and even moving to biometrics, the physiological, facial and auditory data that we give up all the time that can be used to figure out what we are and who we are, sometimes for good purposes, like Natasha said.
Right. But I mean, you can see that it goes both ways. Here's an email from Fred. He said, did companies track this information before Facebook? And I believe Facebook turned 15 years old yesterday. But is this something, Joe, that's specifically about Facebook and Google all of that?
No. These are the largest companies. But as I suggested earlier, this goes back to the earliest days of commercial internet with cookies. Tracking has been part of the business for a very long time. Google was in early on using a marketing company, as it were, to start selling ads based upon tracking. But it's been around for a while.
Go ahead, Natasha.
Well, it far predates the internet, right? Because even before we had the consumer internet, there were offline data brokers
mm-hmm.
that were collecting information about, you know, who bought a house and how much they
yes.
paid for it and were they a registered Republican or Democrat and where did they shop and making profiles of us and selling those. So it's not new. It's just made faster. And the amount of information that can be collected is at an exponential, you know, magnitude compared to what they could do offline. It's not new. And furthermore, even before we kind of had data brokers, in the 1890s, we had the beginning of the first credit bureaus, right, that were collecting information about people to decide if they should be eligible for a loan or a job. And the thing is that those folks were redlining and making up information about people. And we got a law to regulate this called the Fair Credit Reporting Act because those data collection agencies were doing whatever they wanted.
You're right, right. And obviously using it in discriminatory ways. And I do want to talk about the law, but let me read a comment from Ken. And Joe, I'll toss this to you. He says, when I talk to people about this, they're very apathetic. They say things like, I have nothing to hide, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, I mean, people can – I've heard that also from many people. Oftentimes, there are two views about this. One is if you haven't done anything wrong, what do you have to worry about?
Right.
That worry is a problematical issue. And a lot of times it's a matter of basic marketing discrimination. You may be getting a better price than I, even walking down the aisle of a store. Sometimes it can be far more than that, the way police think about you, how they look at your face, for example, that kind of thing. But there's more to it than that. I've been trying to push the idea based on some research that we have that essentially Americans are resigned to this.
Resigned, basically saying I can do nothing about it?
Yeah. I mean, essentially I know what's going on. How can I change anything? Every time I look, something else is happening. So I might as well try to do the best I can with this and enjoy it as it comes.
Go ahead, Natasha. Yeah.
I want to frame it slightly differently because in my spare time, my vacation in the summer, I teach 12th graders and it's sort of a tech ethics and accountability course. And when you say to 12th graders, do you care about privacy? They go, right, because it's abstract. Right. But when I said to them, you know, I told them that the University of Arizona had done a study of college students. You know, college students have ID cards and they swipe them to get into the gym and the dorm and the dining hall and whatever. And for 3 years, the University of Arizona tracked all those swipes and made predictions about who was likely to drop out based on those swipes. And other universities have done similar things based on, you know, try to figure out if students were depressed, right? But when they understood that for 3 years, a university tracked students and they knew who was friends with who because those people were swiping their cards in the dining hall at the same time and swiping their cards at the library at the same time, the students were outraged, right? But these were the same students who said they didn't care about privacy. So part of the problem is if you don't know where your data is going and how it's being used to judge you and how that might make your treatment that you get different or your life trajectory different or the job offer you get different, then of course you're going to be apathetic. But when you understand that there's this huge apparatus that is categorizing you and shunting you in directions that you can't see, a lot of people care.
And that is Natasha Singer. She's a technology reporter at the New York Times who covers data privacy. Also with us, Joe Turow, and he's a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about data privacy, for lack of a better description, a complicated subject and an important one as well. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joe, let me go to you. I have a weather bug app on my phone, and oftentimes when I check in to see what the weather is, it will ask me to tell them or whoever, weather bug, where I am, and I say, no, I'm not going to tell you. Does that mean that they don't know where I am, or is that just a kind of a pro forma?
They may know where you are by, through other ways, but what you're bringing up is an interesting point. A lot of apps, not in this case WeatherBug, may need to know for the weather, but a lot of apps will ask you, can we use your location?
Right.
And they have no interest in your location in terms of the specifics of the app. What they're really interested in is selling your location. And there's this huge marketplace of, as Natasha mentioned earlier, location marketing, which is really a big deal, knowing where you are so they can resell. It is even possible to know what store you've gone to and then where you're heading in order to remarket you something you looked at in the store. So those kinds of – I often will look at the app and say no, particularly if it has nothing to do with my location.
Right. But it sounds like you're saying it's sort of happening anyway.
Yeah, it is. They can tell your location through a number of different ways, including towers and stuff like that, cell towers.
Yeah, but if you've turned on the location service in your phone, they can sometimes tell your location within kind of a 9-foot square
box.
Right,
that's very specific.
Right, down to like you are standing in your bathroom, right? And so, or you're standing inside Starbucks or you're on the sidewalk.
Yes.
And if you don't turn that on, there are other ways, like, for example, if you turn on a Wi-Fi network in a Starbucks, you know, they're going to know you're there. And cell towers, I mean, your cell phone provider always knows where you are. But if you turn on location, you are allowing very, very specific tracking. You know, we did a story about this a couple of months ago.
Yeah, it was great.
My colleagues and I. And one of the people who let us look at her location data, a teacher in upstate New York, the map, when we looked at her location tracking, showed not only that she was teaching in a school, but her school had a kind of curved building. And we could see, like, where her classroom is because all the dots were gathered around her classroom. We could tell when she was in the parking lot. We could tell when she was at recess.
Could you see, I mean, could you tell who was in the classroom with her?
You know, we obtained a data set of location of people, and instead of trying to figure out who they were and then tell them and freak them out, we decided to try to do a privacy-preserving thing where we asked people if we could look for them in our data set. And so this teacher was one of the people we found. But when we looked at schools, we could see a lot of dots on the playground that represented phones, and we could see cars dropping off folks who are going into school or who are hanging out in the playground, and presumably those phones belong to children.
And of course, these activities don't stop with marketers.
Right.
You know, what happens in marketing often goes into political parties, you know, and governments, and particularly the idea of being able to track somebody.
Right.
But even more than that, all these AI uses of data, what you eat, how you eat, where you do, governments can pick this up and run with it. And of course, we saw with Cambridge Analytica and some of the other activities how political parties can do the same thing, political marketers.
Well, in fact, you have looked at Republicans, Democrats, Independents, how they feel about this surveillance that we've been talking about. And what
did
you
find? that was a disconcerting set of findings. We found that essentially your political ideology and your political party determines whether you care or not about the surveillance of people with low income, put it in tightest terms. Looking at the world through the lenses of politics can be very disconcerting when you look at the data.
And I think the data said that maybe don't surveil me, but it's okay to surveil low-income people and their behavior, their habits.
We look mostly about the surveilling of low-income, not so much don't surveil me. But the notion was Democrats were far more concerned about various surveillance practices that affected low-income people, that typically disproportionately affected low-income people compared to Republicans.
How do you interpret that?
To do with the politics and the belief structures, I think, that people have. We tried to think about other possibilities, but it's the world in which we live.
Yeah.
I think it's just a reflection of some of the discord and agendas that politicians set about how we should think about the world. These things interconnect in so many complicated ways.
Natasha, it's interesting to compare how European countries have responded to some of these, this data collection and also privacy issues, comparing that to what happens in Washington, D.C. And there was a recent series of hearings, and it was pretty clear that our elected representatives didn't know much about what was going on. Where does this stand when it comes to what Congress may or may not be doing to deal with things like data privacy?
Well, you mentioned Europe, and I think that that's a really interesting comparison because the European Union decided in its constitution that data privacy and data protection were fundamental human rights. And so they have created regulation based around the notion that you have some rights and control over your data and you have the right to have it protected. And so their regime, on paper at least, is much more stringent than ours. In the United States, we have a bunch of alphabet soup of laws that protect different kinds of information. So HIPAA, the Health Information Privacy Protection system, protects how, like, doctors and insurers can share information about patients, right? And then we have education privacy laws and a video privacy law and a driver's privacy law, right? And so we have this mishmash, and it basically doesn't protect the bulk of the information gathered about Americans. And Congress is in a position now, after the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, after the Russian election influence scandal, after the recent revelations that Facebook was buying the data of teenagers, where various legislators want to do various things. And I think that some people in Congress don't understand the complexity of this issue, and some of them have incredibly good technology advisors who do understand. And there's going to be a huge tug of war because California recently passed a European-style privacy law. It's not as stringent as the European law, but it would give Californians some right to control their data and also to tell companies not to sell their data to others. And the tech industry wants to kill that law.
Yeah,
and so some of them are lobbying Congress to pass a national privacy law that will gut the California law, essentially, that will supersede the California law.
Joe, you're nodding your head. You want to
add
to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate, but the self-regulation issues like this. I mean, that law was basically passed because the powers that be, the companies in California, were worried another a referendum would pass that would be very stringent. So they quickly passed another law, and now they're backing off on that.
Wow.
And they're hoping for a national law because they're worried that states will copy California. And that it'll be increasingly like the European law, which it's.
Do you like the European law?
I'm always too much of a pessimist. Sometimes I'm skeptical. We'll have to see. In France recently, they fined Google $58 million American dollars. It sounds like a lot. I don't think it's a heck of a lot for a very important issue. The argument was that it's almost impossible for a normal person to understand Google's way of using your data. Not that they're not putting it out there, but for a regular person, given the complexities of Google, it's almost impossible to understand. This would be true of Facebook and so many other companies. And whether the larger European Union will pick up on that and fine them even more would be an interesting question.
Very interesting. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Joseph Turow and Natasha Singer about data mining, data privacy. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with the New York Times' Natasha Singer and the University of Pennsylvania's Joseph Turow about data privacy, data mining. Let me get Elizabeth from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I'm really enjoying the conversation. And
thanks.
I wanted to point out, going back to the discussion of user agreements, but I think it applies in a lot of this discussion, that the user has absolutely no power to negotiate one-on-one with a Facebook or a Google or even a WeatherBug app. You either accept the user agreement or you can't use the service. You're not going to be able to take it point by point with one of their lawyers and delete this clause and insert this proviso. So we either it almost isn't worth reading the agreement. You need the service. You've got to accept the agreement as it's written.
It's a really good point. And Joe Turow was nodding his head vigorously there.
It's a tough luck contract. I've brought to my class. I taught a class in privacy a couple of years ago. And I brought some lawyers who write these things. And they pretty well said that they don't think most people could understand them. They just write them. They're contracts, and they're written for other lawyers, essentially.
But, I mean, what Elizabeth is saying, it's kind of a take it or leave
yes,
it.
Yes, it's a take it or leave it, exactly.
Right. So, and you can't obviously negotiate.
Now, the California, correct me if I'm wrong, Natasha, the California law says that even if you don't want to accept it, the companies can't. It's a little bit ambiguous. They can't charge you less for the service. They can't penalize you for saying that you don't want to accept their privacy law.
I think that that is theoretically correct, but they are duking it out about how actually that's going to be regulated.
Exactly.
And I just wanted to say something about the weather app, though. you can choose a different weather app.
Yeah.
And there is weather.com, which is owned by IBM. Mm-hmm. And you can choose to turn on location services and accept the very specific tracking. Or you can actually not turn on location tracking. It means you're going to have to plug in your zip code, and that may be a pain.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also turn on location tracking when you want to get the local weather automatically and turn it off when you are not needing the location-based weather. And, like, it does require more intervention by the consumer. It is not frictionless. But there are a kind of minor choices you can make to not have to accept full-scale surveillance.
Joe, when we talk to Siri or Alexa, what does she know about us?
Well, it's an interesting question. Amazon reserves the right to take everything, the actual
voice.
But
what do they take? If it's in, you know, it's a little module that sits in a room somewhere.
If you say, Alexa, what's the weather? That's stored. That's kept. But it's kept by Amazon even in the biometric form of the voice. Amazon will not share that part of it with the app, with the skill. So they get a transcript of what you ask.
But why would they care that I'm asking about the weather?
Well, let's say you have – there are skills that are about the weather. Why would Amazon care?
Yeah.
For one thing, they care that you should like the particular, you know, Echo
that I'm
device.
Using, whatever the
I
device
I mean, there's
is.
A lot of reasons that Amazon came up with this. Part of it has to do with your buying it, and eventually they're hoping to sell you lots of products relating to the kinds of things. So they're you know, putting huge numbers of skills, encouraging companies to create these skills. But they're also it's also part of learning who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, I mean, if you have more than one, which numbers of people do, you label them where you're talking. So are you asking this in your bedroom? Are you asking it in your kitchen? The Alexa in my house knows my voice. When I say, please read the news, it'll say, Joe. And then it will go on and talk. So there are ways that that eventually Amazon will use this if they're not already using it now.
Natasha, you wrote recently about the facial technology or facial recognition technology. What's the status on that?
So many companies are using face recognition. If you are on Facebook and you have turned on this thing, or you haven't turned off this thing called a tag suggestion, right? It's the thing that helps automatically tag the names of people in your photos. Apple and Microsoft have systems where instead of putting in a numerical, you know, code to unlock your phone or your laptop, you can use your face. You show your face and it recognizes you and locks your device. And Amazon is also selling this technology to the police.
Huh?
And so there are numerous controversies about the spread of facial recognition technology because it's really, really powerful. Once there is a named image of your face, then any time you go somewhere else that has a facial recognition, if you're in a store, out on the street, you can be identified. And so one of the concerns about the police having it is, first of all, will they misuse it on, you know, African Americans or Latinos or people they think are immigrants? But there are other issues about, like, imagine you go to a protest and the police have face recognition and they can run the images of your face against driver's license database photos. And then they know everybody in a protest and who came together and who left together. So there are all kinds of concerns about the spread of face recognition and the risk that it is going to end the ability of Americans to be anonymous and go about their business in public.
Yeah, and in China, not too long ago, they extolled the idea that they had discovered, I think, three criminals in a large stadium of thousands of people through the use of facial recognition.
Wow.
Exactly how they did that, I suspected, as people moved in to the stadium. But that's pretty astounding, and it's clear that that kind of use is in the future.
And Natasha, as it stands today with facial recognition technology, does it do better with certain kinds of faces over other kinds of faces?
So there is a researcher at the MIT Media Lab, and she's been looking at this question, and she did a study last year, and it showed that Microsoft and IBM's system were much better at identifying the gender of white men than identifying the gender of women or darker-skinned people in photos. And it was really interesting because Amazon and IBM immediately improved their systems. IBM said it had been working on it for months anyway, but they very, very quickly came out with new systems, and she tested them again, and they are much improved. And she recently did a similar study where she found similar problems with Amazon, and Amazon said, you're wrong, and plus your data is irrelevant.
Oh, gosh.
It's really interesting to see the different attitudes of tech companies. Brad Smith, who's the president of Microsoft, has come out and said face recognition technology is so powerful and the risks are so big that actually companies should not self-regulate. This is a moment where Congress needs to get in there and put some limits in place. And Jeff Bezos of Amazon has said, you know, of course technology has risks, but that shouldn't stop innovation. And when we find harms, we'll deal with them. And it's a very different approach.
Mindset.
Microsoft is taking a proactive approach, and Amazon is taking a reactive wait till people get harmed approach.
Fascinating. Let me see what Ruben from Philadelphia has to say. And Ruben, go ahead. You are on Radio Times, and we are getting him set up. There he is. Hi, Ruben. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
My name's Ruben Levy. I'm the founder and director of a nonprofit organization called Living Online Lab. And we've developed a curriculum for teaching internet studies in schools. In your opinion, how does one best protect youth as their privacy, their identity, their data, et cetera, without driving more fear in the discussion?
Well, interestingly, you called Ruben only because Natasha teaches high school students at the School of the New York Times. And is there a way of educating maybe even beyond children about this without scaring us all to death?
Well, I think one of the things is to give kids a chance to rethink our system. And so, you know, we talk about how face recognition is going to be everywhere or AI is going to be everywhere. And what I teach my students is, like, if we say it's inevitable, then we're not dealing with the big questions, right? We are not dealing with how we want it to look or even are there some uses we don't want to have. Mm-hmm. And so I just taught a class in January with high school students where they had to write a privacy law. Mm-hmm. And we got into three teams, right? There was the consumer team, there was the industry team, there was the legislative team, and each group had to understand the point of view of their side. And each group had to write a law based on their side, which meant they had to learn all these crazy laws we have in the U.S., the video privacy law and the genetic privacy law, and they had to understand what was going on in Europe, and they had to understand how data tracking works. And then they got together after they've written their laws and they had to negotiate, right? And, you know, I tweeted a little bit about it, and somebody who used to be at the Commerce Department, Cameron Carey, it's John Kerry's brother, you know, tweeted back, hey, can you send me that? He was joking. But, like, the kids really, like, they really, really thought really deeply about how can we balance the need for consumers to actually understand what's happening and be insulated from the biggest risks while allowing companies to use data, A, to make the services we use better, and right. B, to make new ones. And so I think that you empower students by allowing them to envision what could be, not being freaked out by what is and agreeing with the status quo.
I mean, I would like to take that class. I would
just
go ahead.
That's absolutely terrific. And I think Natasha's perspective is terrific on this. What I find, I teach a freshman class, have for many years. It's called Media Industries and Society. And I ask the students, usually 80 to 100 students,
right.
How many people have taken any class on media or the internet? And usually out of those, two people raise their hand. They're just not getting this stuff in high school.
But even living it, don't you
They're
think?
Living it, but they know so little about it. They know how to work it, but they don't understand what goes on behind the screen. They don't understand the ethical issues really about it. The kinds of things that Natasha was talking about, they have no clue. No one's ever brought it up for them.
Huh. You know, I just want to add one more thing, actually, that reminds me for
sure,
suggestions for teaching students. And it actually doesn't matter if they're in a college or high school or in sixth grade. But one of the things I ask my students to do is to write something about one app or technology they use.
Mm-hmm.
And they often write a lot about Snapchat because mm-hmm. it's the most popular thing. But, like, one of my students wrote about an app that her teacher used to basically manage the class, and he awarded students points. It's called Class Dojo. You get points for raising your hand. If you're, you know, raise it nicely, you get points taken away from you if you talk out of turn or whatever.
Yeah.
And she was describing what it felt like, and she was saying, you know, kids are raising their hands just to get the points.
Yeah.
It really changed the dynamic of the class. And she wrote, we felt like lab rats.
Going to say, like Skinnerbox.
Yeah,
people.
Yeah.
And the thing is, though, but when you ask students to analyze how technology is affecting them, then they understand, you know, both what is good about it and how they are being kind of shunted into, like, staying up till 2 a.m. in the morning watching YouTube. And it means that they are going to be more savvy consumers of technology, there are going to be more savvy regulators, policymakers, and if they go into the industry, they're going to be more savvy innovators and, you know, thinking about privacy and security and the downstream consequences. So I think even just asking students to reflect on one thing they use, you know, write 400 words, right? Don't write 12,000 words. And it's the thinking about it. And, like, you get these crazy animated discussions about the features they like and the features that actually make them upset about certain apps like Snapchat.
Ruben, I appreciate you raising the question. This is an interesting comment from Celeste. Listening to the show as you began to talk about Alexa, my Alexa made its listening sound awaiting a command. Very creepy. Sorry about that, Celeste. A comment from Natasha. If I turn my phone off, can it still track data like location? Can it, Joe?
No. If it's fully off.
Right. I mean, the question is, do people really ever really turn their phones off, right? Anything you want to add to that, Natasha?
I feel like it benefits the tech industry and many other companies to put the onus on consumers to control how their data spreads. And the power imbalance is so huge that even if we give consumers more insight, I'm not sure. In fact, I'm quite sure that we're not going to still have very much control. And so the question is whether Congress needs to limit certain collection of data and certain use of data. So, for example, should companies be able to use our non-health data to make health predictions about us? I think that that's like a conversation we need to have as a society and not put it on the individual who may not understand that their tweets can show if they're depressed or have insomnia.
I've even begun to wonder whether there should, and I'd be interested to know what Natasha thinks about, whether the number of data points companies use about people should be limited. Because once you begin to pour numbers of data points about someone, you can make enormous generalizations about people that may be very upsetting if people knew what was going on.
Did we know how many, I mean, on average, how many data points?
Think about the kind of things that we were just talking about, Alexa, that Amazon knows about you. Right. You know, in terms of what you purchase, now what you say, you know, when you say it, how you say it. Amazon has a patent now for figuring out the tone that you speak to Amazon Alexa with it. And then at least the example of the patent, it says, you sound like you're sick. Would you like some chicken soup?
That's gracious. An email from Deirdre. A few years ago, I bought a pregnancy test at CVS, and 8 months later, I received a free case of Similac formula. I ended up not being pregnant. I believe I got this case of formula because I had used my CVS discount card to buy the pregnancy test 8 months earlier. I have since stopped using the card. Natasha, let me just ask you, we're almost out of time here, but there was an interesting study done recently of people that essentially gave up being on Facebook. And while they were less informed, they also described feeling happier. What should we make of that?
I think that we have a lot of social pressure online to perform. You know that. Everybody's vacation has the beautiful pictures and not the pictures of the rain. Everybody's children are beautiful. Everybody's, you know, boyfriend or spouse or partner, you know, is handsome and, you know, giving you gifts. I mean, like, nothing bad happens. Well, sometimes.
Sometimes.
You know, it's like, I don't want to dismiss the fact that when people have difficulties, they can share that and find groups of people. But I think that being performative all the time is exhausting. And also, you know, maybe you spend less time online and you're actually interacting in real life with real humans. And there's kind of a huge benefit to that.
Well, we're going to leave it on that note. My thanks to both of you. Natasha Singer, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a technology reporter for the New York Times who covers data privacy. And she also teaches technology ethics to high school students at the School of the New York Times. Joseph Turow, thank you for coming in and joining us as well.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
I did as well. And he's a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. His most recent book is The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. Appreciate all those calls and comments to the show as well. You can carry on this conversation on Facebook if you want to do that. I know it's kind of strange to say that after this hour. And Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.